Thank you. Good morning, everyone. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank Bloomberg for hosting me this morning. I'm really looking forward to the Q&A. But before I get there, I'd like to first also start with my own acknowledgement of country. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which we are meeting today. We're very lucky here in Australia to have a First Nations people that protect our land and culture and hand that down to future generations. So I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present and extend that respect to any First Nations people here with us today. So as you can see on the screen today, I'm going to be talking about inflation and how we, the RBA, are thinking about the impact of the current conflict in Iran on inflation outcomes here at home. So let me start by clarifying what the RBA's price stability objective means and what it doesn't. To be quite specific, the goal is to achieve average prices growth across a broad range of goods and services, that is the CPI, of between 2 to 3% per year. At any point in time, the price for a particular good or service might be rising faster or slower than others. But what we're focused on is what's happening on average across all of those goods and services. This matters because factors outside of a central bank's control can shift the price of a good or a small group of goods relative to the rest. So examples include increases in the global price of oil, as we are experiencing right now, or the long-run fall in the price of electronics. As you can see on the chart, on a like-for-like basis, computers today are much, much cheaper than they were 10 or 20 years ago. Now, monetary policy won't target such relative price changes. Rather, our focus is making sure that these narrow price changes don't spread into sustained broader price changes or inflation, which pushes inflation consistently above or below our target. Now, when we think about the outlook for inflation, it's important to have a clear framework for what drives prices. This helps us understand how different economic conditions will show up in inflation. Intuitively, in most of our frameworks, the key driver of what happens to prices is what happens to firms' costs, which in turn reflect broader economic conditions. But it's pretty hard to directly measure firms' costs across the entire economy. So our models and frameworks generally capture the drivers of costs indirectly. Now, to do this, we tend to focus on two main drivers or buckets of drivers: the extent of domestic capacity pressures and other costs related to supply conditions like import prices, which is where oil comes into it. Domestic cost pressures include things like wages, rents, intermediate inputs, and anything else that mainly reflect the balance of supply and demand in the domestic economy. In our frameworks, we capture domestic cost pressures using measures of spare capacity, such as the unemployment, underemployment, or the output gap. Now, these measures are aggregates, but what they're attempting to do is capture the extent to which aggregate demand is above or below the economy's productive, sustainable capacity. When activity outstrips capacity for a time, inflation tends to be above target, as everyone is competing for the economy's scarce resources. Now, when this happens, monetary policy can bring inflation back to target by slowing demand momentum to bring it back into balance with the economy's productive capacity. In the medium term, there is no trade-off between achieving sustainable full employment and stable inflation. Now, I think this chart illustrates this point very well. It plots a measure of spare capacity, the labour underutilisation rate, against inflation. This depiction is often referred to as the Phillips curve for those that did economics in the room. When the labour market is tight and the economy is operating beyond its productive capacity, that is, when the underutilisation rate is relatively low, inflation tends to be higher and vice versa. This pickup in inflation can be quite sharp when the labour market becomes very tight, as you can see, and this non-linearity is something I'll return to a bit later, and my colleague, Deputy Governor Hauser, will discuss in more detail in a speech he's giving in June. Now, not all cost pressures reflect domestic conditions, as I said earlier. Businesses can also face higher costs if the price of imports rise or if factors disrupt production. In this case, inflation will be higher for any given level of spare capacity in the domestic economy. Now, economists typically refer to these kinds of drivers of inflation as external supply shocks. Our standard models and frameworks try to capture these shocks by including things like the cost of imports or other factors that might be specific to the shock, we had to get quite creative during COVID, for example. And increases in oil prices are a natural example of an external supply shock. They directly increase costs for firms and households in the form of fuel and other refined oil products. In the CPI, spending on the fuel you put in your car accounts for around 3.5% of the total basket. These fuel costs also have indirect effects because fuel is used in the production and transport of other goods and services that firms use and consumers buy. In addition to the cost, to the shock itself, a key question is how much of that cost shock will be passed through by firms to the prices of those other goods and services. The timing and extent of this pass-through is always uncertain. On average across history, pass-through has typically been gradual and not always complete. And this finding actually was confirmed by the recent Macquarie Business Outlook Scenario Survey, which suggested that factors like long-term sale price contracts and the potentially temporary nature of the oil price increase may lessen pass-through into final prices. The starting point for the economy can also matter and influence the speed and extent of pass-through. Recent research has shown that when capacity is constrained and inflation is already elevated, firms are more willing to adjust their prices, so the inflationary impulse is passed on more quickly and more fully. Estimates from RBA research that's just been released today, you can find it on our website, suggests that this type of dynamic accounted for between 0.5 and 1.25 percentage points of the pickup in inflation observed in Australia over 2022 and 2023, which is what this chart here is suggesting. Actual inflation came through a bit higher than we might have expected based on historical averages. But you probably recall that 2022 and 23 were a time where we had the Ukraine war breakout, but also the economy rebounding from COVID and running pretty fast. And it's not just current costs that matter, because firms tend to avoid changing their prices too frequently. This reflects the effort and cost it takes to change prices by printing new price tags, long-term contracts, such as rental agreements, and a range of other factors. The same RBA research I mentioned just before has found that in non-food retail and outside of sale periods, only around 10% of prices change each month. In most cases, it's just not possible, or it's very costly for firms to change prices every time their input costs change. So this means that when they're setting their prices, they'll try to account for future expected costs. This highlights why it's so important to keep expectations for future costs and price increases, i.e. inflation, well anchored. If businesses and households expect high future inflation, this can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, as these expectations get baked into contracts for goods, services, and wages. Now, central banks have long reiterated the importance of managing inflation expectations and the need for monetary policy to keep them anchored. If a supply shock leads to an increase in expectations, this can give rise to larger second-round effects. Moreover, if expectations rise persistently, it becomes harder for the central bank to bring inflation back to target, as it must bring expectations back down and restore the balance between supply and demand. Doing so may require a more substantial slowing of economic activity, as we saw during the early 1990s. So that's why central banks, we all think it's pretty crucial that we keep inflation expectations anchored to our respective inflation targets. So with that framework in mind, how are we thinking about the outlook and incorporating the impact of the conflict in the Middle East? Well, I think it's important that we start from where the economy was before the conflict broke out. And at that point in time, inflation was already above target. And we think domestic cost pressures partly explain this. A range of indicators point to conditions being tight in early 2026, including both the share of firms reporting labour constraints and non-mining capacity utilisation being above their historical average. Our frameworks for modelling inflation that I discussed earlier indicate that these capacity pressures have continued to put some upward pressure on inflation. Now, prior to the conflict, we were expecting that growth in activity would slow over this year and remain a bit subdued in 2027. That reflected tighter financial conditions and the waning boost from factors that have supported growth recently. And all else being equal, This easing in capacity pressures was expected to help bring inflation back down towards target. That's the dashed lines you can see on this chart. But all else is not equal. The Middle East conflict is a clear external shock, as I said earlier. While the duration of the conflict is uncertain, economists generally agree that the disruption in global oil and natural gas markets will lead to higher inflation here and overseas, and that's going to work through several channels. First, the increase in the cost of filling our cars with fuel, it flows directly into headline inflation. And that's true here and around the world. Australian petrol prices rose by around 36% at their peak, which was in March, though they have fallen back in recent weeks, reflecting both lower refined oil prices and some excise changes. Diesel prices actually rose by even more, and they remain well above their pre-conflict levels. Now, largely via these direct effects, our May forecast, that's the solid line on this chart, see headline inflation peaking at 4.8% in the June quarter, significantly higher than we were expecting in our February forecasts. Secondly, higher fuel prices are going to influence prices, inflation, indirectly. Domestically, fuel accounts for around 2 to 2.5% of the cost of producing and distributing other goods and services in the CPI, which you can see on the chart. Components that are more exposed to fuel prices include travel, that's the top bar, that's airfares, effectively, transport and postal services, some grocery items, farming uses a lot of diesel in production, and new dwelling construction. Again, raw materials and the transporting of them have heavy influence on the new dwelling construction costs. In addition, oil is also an input in global supply chains and will influence imported goods prices. For example, oil and natural gas are used in the manufacture of fertilizers and plastics, and the cost of these goods has started to rise as well. Now, returning to the earlier framework I outlined, the effect of these input costs on the prices faced by consumers will depend on the degree to which firms pass through cost increases and the timing of when firms review their prices and their expectations for those future costs. How quickly firms pass through higher costs is a key assumption embedded in our forecast. And consistent with the findings of our research and what I said earlier about the economy already operating with some supply constraints, we're assuming that this will occur relatively quickly. Reports from our liaison program suggest that some firms have responded already, with fuel surcharges being put in place by firms at the start of supply chains, and this is then flowing through into a broad set of industries. Now, expectations for pass-through to consumer prices do vary at the moment, but we are hearing from some firms that they plan to increase their retail prices. For example, some construction firms, who are relatively highly exposed, as I just mentioned, are reviewing prices for new contracts. And this is particularly the case in regions where demand is still growing strongly and supply capacity is constrained, consistent with the findings of that research. Now, putting this all together, our forecast for underlying inflation has been revised higher in the near term. The indirect effects of the shock to oil prices is expected to contribute around 0.4 percentage points to underlying inflation in the March quarter 2027, so that's over the next 12 months. Underlying inflation then eases and headline inflation falls due to declines in oil and travel prices. As you can see on the chart, we move back down the blue dots to a lower rate of trim mean inflation. Now, this baseline reflects several assumptions, and in a similar way to Treasury, we did explore some alternative scenarios in our SMP to talk through what might happen if some of these assumptions didn't come true. First, and possibly most importantly, the conflict in the Middle East in our baseline forecast is assumed to be resolved in the near future, and this causes some fallback in oil prices over 2026 and into 2027, though the price of oil at the end of our forecast horizon is higher than it was pre-conflict. And that's based on market pricing for those in the room that are watching the futures curve. Second, domestic capacity pressures in the economy are expected to ease. Now, this is partly driven by the impact of higher prices on households' budgets and spending. The increase in oil prices has made households, that's all of us, poorer in real terms, and we expect this to weigh on household spending. It is also linked to the assumed cash rate increases, which help to further rebalance supply and demand in the economy, And again, we use market pricing as our cash rate assumption. So altogether then, this leads to a decline in inflation to the middle of the target band by early 2028. Now, as I said, while this is our central case, significant uncertainties remain. Oil prices could stay elevated for longer than implied by market pricing. And the Iran conflict could lead to broader, more persistent supply disruptions, adding further to inflation. And that's the possibility that's explored in the scenarios in the S&P. Cost pass-through may also be stronger than assumed, and higher fuel prices could lift and embed higher inflation expectations. RBA research has shown that fuel prices are particularly salient for people when they form their expectations. We drive past petrol stations every day. It's pretty hard to miss that price. And so that means this particular shock may result in expectations lifting. But on the other hand, inflation may be lower. Households and businesses could cut back on consumption and investment by more than we anticipate in response to cost of living pressures and the uncertainty that we're all facing into. And we're very conscious this is yet another shock in a series of what have felt like quite rapidly repeating shocks. And individuals may try to work more, increasing the economy's productive capacity. And this was what we observed over the post-pandemic inflation and hiking cycle. It's fair to say there is a lot of uncertainty about how things are going to play out from here. Now, at its recent meeting, the Monetary Policy Board weighed up pre-existing domestic conditions, the impact of higher oil prices, and the likelihoods of the risks I noted materialising. The recent rise in oil prices is particularly challenging to navigate for central banks and for us. Higher oil prices mean higher costs and higher consumer prices in the near term. That's a given. But this shock has come against a backdrop of elevated capacity constraints and domestic cost pressures. Given these starting conditions, our research suggests that pass-through will be faster and more extensive, and the risk of inflation expectation drifting higher is elevated, we think. On balance, the board decided to raise the cash rate to 4.35%, but they noted that they will remain attentive to the data and evolving assessment of the outlook and risk to the economy. Thank you, and I'm looking forward to taking your questions.
Dr. Hunter, thank you very much for your presentation and the speech today, very well received. And thank you everyone here for joining us. Just very first, before we kick things off, very first housekeeping is that we're going to have a QR code that's going to pop up on the screen, and we're doing the Q&A through that. So I've got a couple of questions, but after that, I'll be scanning the iPad no, I don't always wear this tie. I'll filter better for the rest of the session. Okay, well, we've heard Governor Bullock discuss this. We've now heard you discuss inflation expectations. I'm not going to be very surprised if Deputy Governor Hauser doesn't talk about inflation expectations when he gets up in the not too distant future. We've also, you noted, and it's something that that we've put out in our work about how much in the short run those expectations are very highly influenced by those prices that people see every day, and particularly that core anchor, the pump price, the petrol price. We've seen that has come down to almost pre-war levels and pretty much where we were through 2025, thanks to a higher Aussie dollar, the cost of living relief from the government. So according to the petrol price, it's over. Right? What are you guys worried about? What's coming?
So, I'm not going to pretend we have a crystal ball on how things play out from here. I wish I did. I can give it a rub and we'd be ahead of the curve. We're not. We don't know how this is going to play out. I mean, I think petrol prices are really important, and you're right, they have come back down through a combination of different factors. But they are salient for expectations, but they're not the only price that matters. I think just in terms of filling up your car, some people in the room might well be driving diesel vehicles. Diesel prices have not come back down all the way. They have come down a fair amount, though. And we're also conscious that expectations are anchored actually to a wide variety of goods and services. Some are have more impact than others, which is what we mean by salient, but that doesn't mean the others don't count. And we can see in the surveys and in other measures of short-term expectations that those have lifted up. We're not surprised to see that. That's what we would expect in this kind of shock. But it is something that we're conscious of and mindful of. And I think Really, as I said in my opening remarks, it's another inflationary shock that's coming through not that long after the last one, which was not that long after the one before. So there's, a combination of things that mean we're always mindful and watching inflation expectations. That's the job. I don't think you'll ever get a central banker say they're not worried about expectations. But we are perhaps more worried now than we have been in the past because of circumstance and what we're facing into. But no, you're not wrong on petrol prices. They have come back down.
Now, it's tempting when you're preparing for one of these things, we're all jumping into AI now to come up with questions. But one of the issues that has come up in the governor post press conference, you've mentioned it again, is where we were and that pressure on the economy going into this shock. So we've got it, the inflation shock from oil. We're going to have a lot of we're yet to really meaningfully see the confidence shock of this that's come through to consumers and businesses reining back in their spending. But we're hearing constantly new announcements all the time. The government working with the hyperscalers. There are this massive wave of investment coming into the economy. I would imagine that's troubling. We might need to make way for that. How is the RBA thinking about how AI, this construction boom, is affecting the economy?
Yeah, look, I mean, the AI boom is spectacular by any measures. I think just looking at what it's doing to the global economy at the moment, we can see the investment that's happening in the US. We can see the supply chain implications of that across Asia. So, when you build a data center, wherever you're building it in the world, you're probably importing substantial amounts of capital from Asia. That's the machinery and equipment that goes in it because they have that in their manufacturing base. So we can see its impact very clearly, and we can also see it happening here in Australia. We got a big burst of activity back in the September quarter. It was sort of held into the back end of last year. We'll get capital expenditure expectations in the next couple of weeks, and that will give us a bit more of a read on going forward. But we do expect that there will be further activity. That's pretty clear. In terms of how that then fits into that broader, bigger picture for the outlook for the economy and how do we think about it, I mean, we really do think about aggregate demand and how that measures up against the economy's productive capacity. In this particular case, we'll think about two things. One is the size of the activity, but also, I think, importantly, two, what size of that activity is happening domestically and what are we importing? Because, as I just said, we import the computers, the servers, and all the other equipment, largely, that gets placed in the data center. So we do have to build the shed, I'm told is the right word from the guys that operate in this sector. But what goes in it, that comes from overseas. So there's two things that we have to think about, because if we're importing it, that's not adding to our domestic aggregate demand. So we are conscious of that balance, and it is an aggregate picture. It is incredible how the economy will respond and move resources to where they're most in demand. And that's what matters for policy, but you also have to remember the import side.
I'll go one more before opening it to the floor, although this is sort of also prompted or linked into one of the questions from the floor. Thank you, Neil. And when we think about that AI boom, yep, a lot of jobs building the sheds, but we could have been building those sheds for something else. I'm an economist, but for Bloomberg, but I don't think that there's that many jobs in those sheds compared to the jobs that we would have seen before. And then we do have the impact as AI continues to be rolled out through the economy on productivity, employment in a whole range of sectors. Pointed out that the US, AI is a very big part of the demand story we've got there, but we're seeing very low US jobs growth. I was conscious of one of the research pieces you pulled up towards the end there, talking about highlighting how sometimes participation is encouraged, or we do see a lift in participation when monetary policy does tighten. It's been the unemployment rate we're looking at now. If we kept the 2025 participation at the beginning of 2025, we'd have a almost 5% unemployment rate, a different policy discussion. If we find ourselves with if Trump seems to get a nice deal, if he gets a magical deal, Strait of Hormuz, we get some things flowing again, it'll be a while before supply chains come down. but we've got this AI investment boom. If the inflation supply shock dissipates and we get a bit of a participation boom, that's sort of an environment that's maybe low inflation, maybe a bit higher unemployment. How quickly can we pivot?
Pivot is an interesting word to use. I think maybe there's a few sort of different themes in your question there. I'd say just in terms of the impact of AI on the labour market, which is one potential theme, I think we really do have to wait and see. The governor actually gave a speech the second half of last year talking about this and some of the different channels. I think that our expectation is that AI takes away some of the more mundane, repeatable, routine tasks that we probably all have in our jobs to varying extents. And that will be very good for productivity because, you know, AI doesn't have to take a holiday, doesn't get sick. And it will change the way people work and the jobs that they do. But I also think that if we look back through history, what you can see from sort of repeated waves of generalized technology like this, this is technology that cuts right across the economy that's not specific to one sector, you generally find that jobs adapt and evolve and we change the way we work. And that changes the shape of organisations. It also usually enables a whole bunch of new jobs that have not existed in the past. And the personal computer is a really great example of that. There's a large proportion of jobs that exist today didn't exist in about 1980, pre the personal computer. The other example I quite like on this was someone pointing out to me that when the spreadsheet came into being and Microsoft Excel was rolled out across computers in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, at the time people were saying this is the end for accountants. Excel's just going to do away with their jobs completely and we won't need them because, you know, you've got this technology that does it for you. That's not quite come to pass, of course. So I think that we have to be a little bit careful and it's hard to imagine what the new jobs are because we haven't seen them before, but I think that we will get at least some of those. In terms of your other sort of more cyclical question, I suppose, about, you know, what happens if the labour market softens a bit more than we anticipate, if we get a faster resolution to the conflict, or perhaps more pertinently from a macroeconomic perspective, that the oil price comes back down more quickly, that the flows return, that the system normalises. That's a different view of the world, absolutely. That's why the job for us is never done. And we'll certainly be watching for that. And it's one of the risks that we're certainly cognizant of. I spoke about it in my speech. And if that happens, then obviously the board will make their decisions. And that's why they are always attentive to what's happening, to how things are playing out and how the data is playing out. That line is used quite a lot, but that's the reason, because we know things are always changing.
Yep. No, if anything, Treasurer Chalmers talked about his productivity agenda, but just thinking of those accountants with the Excel, I think if there's anyone out of the budget that's got a bright 2-3 years ahead of them, it's definitely the accounting and legal sector. Another question from the floor. This one's from David Taylor. Going to sort of slightly add a little bit to it. You mentioned in your speech and also Governor Bullock mentioned it, is, you know, we have seen a real wage decline or a decline in living standards. And then as if we sort of do see some downward pressure on the property market post the budget and also post the rate hikes, how do you see the combination of those things? On the one hand, if there is overcorrection of investor demand and we see rents rise in the property market versus the wealth effect of those property prices going down. Where of those sort of post-budget or post-rate hike housing challenges, has anything shifted and how are you thinking about how that might affect inflation?
Absolutely. Look, this is a really tough time for households in terms of what's happening with real incomes. As I said, we can't do anything about this shock. It's literally come to us from overseas. It's not something we have in our control. And it's going to flow through the economy. It already is. And we're going to find out what the impact will be as we get the data, of course. But this is definitely tough. We hear that in our liaison program when we talk to community organizations. We know some people in the community are doing it really, really tough. And we do also know as well, you mentioned the rate hikes, that when we use the interest rate, it is a blunt tool. It affects different people in different ways, and those distributional aspects are very tangible and they matter, even if, you know, they, in an aggregate sense, they at least partially offset one another. So, if you've got a mortgage, higher rates are more challenging, absolutely. But we also have a bunch of people that are savers, where it's obviously the opposite impact. And of course, we are just trying to get inflation down, and that is good for everybody once we manage that. So that's obviously the North Star for us. So we are conscious of that. We'll be looking to see what impact some of those changes to tax treatments and how they flow through into the housing market, how they might flow through the economy more broadly. We're still digesting the budget and what it means, and so we'll have more to say that in coming months in our next set of forecasts and beyond that. But in general, that household wealth channel is important as well. And so we'll be monitoring that very closely. But in the type of scenario, I think that, that David, you have in mind, if it's a weaker outlook for consumer spending, then that is flows through to weaker aggregate demand. And again, policy, monetary policy will respond to that as appropriate. So we're not blind to it. We do see it. And it's a constant job of tracking it. I'm very lucky to have an absolutely fantastic team that work for me that do excellent work day in, day out, unsung heroes in all of this. This is what they'll be looking at over the coming months.
One final one. There's a lot to choose through here. Thank you for the person that pointed out my inability to comment on non-traded inflation in the services sector, particularly regards to haircuts. But what there was an interesting question that came through, which is about trying to dive into how you might be thinking about the aggregate demand impacts of different types of expenditure. Oh, sorry, the employment outcomes of different types of aggregate demand within the economy. So thinking about building those sheds, but also if we think about within public demand as well, we've got what's been articulated in the budget papers. Again, we have to sort of see whether that all comes to pass. We've got a shift from a very large expansion of a labour-intensive services set within the economy, within the social assistance sector, and a rotation away from butter more towards guns and a capital-intensive expansion of that type of spending. That and AI, how when we sort of, when you're thinking about this is the level of business investment, that's my jobs impact, this is my level of public demand, that's my job impact, how is the team, and they are a very talented team, how is the team thinking through and dissecting that?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. And I know it can probably seem a little bit like we I usually describe it as a widget view of the economy, that we just make widgets and we have these models that just have demand or supply, and it's just one thing, one product, one good, one service. Obviously, that's not the real world at all. And so that complexity and what you're talking about in terms of how does labour demand interact with the composition of aggregate demand, and when that composition is changing in particular, that is definitely a focus for us. In fact, you mentioned in recent years, not actually so much over the last year, but in the years before that, we had the growth of the non-market sector, and non-market sector employment was a key driver of overall employment. We actually did quite a lot of research into understanding that link, and I think I'll point you back to our February 2025, I think it was, SMP, where we actually had a call-out chapter that deep-dived on this. And so now, yes, conditions are changing, things are pivoting. That composition of employment growth has definitely changed. The market economy has picked up a bit. We've seen a bit of a slowdown in the non-market. It's choppy quarter to quarter, certainly very choppy month to month, so I wouldn't recommend looking at that data particularly. But we are, we're very conscious of that and that consideration, and really how that shows up not only in the labour market, but ultimately into inflation. And then the final piece of the puzzle that the team have to put into the mix on all of this is that labour supply response. And that was been very interesting to observe. Another bit of research that we've done where we did find through COVID, as I mentioned, that for some people, they did supply more labour to the economy. So they wanted more hours, perhaps, or that's a second person in the home wanted to take on a job because of those cost of living pressures. We think that some of the drop back in participation in recent times is because those cost of living pressures have eased. They're still there, but they're just slightly less acute than they were maybe a year or two ago. And so we're conscious that that might be reversing, and what does that mean? But also then thinking beyond that, what does it mean into the medium long term? So yes, all of those things are definitely on the list, and we definitely look at them. And we often talk about them in the SNP, though I know it's a long document, and it's a good page turner for when you go to bed. But as when I'm up here giving speeches like this, when others are, we do like to flag it, because we think these questions are important.
Dr. Hunter, Sarah, thank you very, very much for your time.